Hey guys. All right. Well, thank you very much for still being awake at this time, and thank you for being at our session. My name is Ray Bango, and I'm a developer evangelist from Microsoft, focusing on web technologies. And to my right is Tyson Matnich, who is the lead developer for the Microsoft.com redesign. How many of you heard about the new Microsoft Responsive redesign? It's pretty awesome, huh? Yeah, I mean, there was some great work, and Tyson was instrumental in that, along with the Microsoft.com team, and they did some great work. So in this session, it's called Don't Break the Web, and what we're going to do is we're going to talk about web standards. We're going to talk about what you should consider when you're thinking about web standards. What's the process behind web standards? What's a stable feature? What's an emerging feature? How do you think about using web standards in a responsible way? And how do you accommodate for non-modern browsers? And the great thing is that we're also going to follow that up with real-life world examples from Tyson himself and some of the stuff that he had to go through as he was working on the Microsoft.com redesign. So I'll get back to you in a little bit, and we'll talk about that. So I think everybody wakes up in the morning at some point and says, all right, I'm going to plug in a device. We kind of take it for granted that this just works, right? You pull out your laptop, maybe it's a lamp, and you just plug it in, and guess what? All of a sudden, magically, electricity works. And we don't think about it. We just do it. And we've done that since, you know, at a very early age. And the reason that we don't have to think about it is because somebody already thought about the standards that are involved for electrical devices. And thankfully, NEMA has done that for us. They've outlined the standards for electrical devices so that we could take a plug and plug it into any wall outlet and it just kind of works. And that's a really important thing for our day-to-day lives. It makes our lives easier. It makes the lives easier for electrical equipment manufacturers. They don't have to worry about a lot of different plugs and things like that. It just makes things substantially easier. Well, in the web development space, we have the same thing. We have organizations like the W3C, ECMA International, and even the Internet Engineering Task Force, which they've gone ahead and defined standards and specifications for some key technologies such as HTML. Come on, five. All right. This little language called JavaScript, which some people use. I think it's pretty important. And then, of course, something that's incredibly important, the TCP/IP protocol, which gives us the Internet. And that's a very important thing. But again, these standard bodies have helped define that to make things incredibly easy when we're doing our web development work or just surfing the internet. Now, when you think about standards, I want you to think of them in two different ways, stable and emerging. It's really important that as a web developer to really understand this. Now, when you're thinking about stable standards, you're thinking about standards that have been properly vetted. There's no recent changes going on. You're not going to get a property that's renamed at the last minute. You're not going to get something that's going to be pulled out. It's been vetted by, let's say, the W3C. You know that it's something you can depend on. It's really important. And you can depend on it to work inside your website. Also, from our perspective at Microsoft, when we look at Internet Explorer, one of the things that we try to look at is whether a feature is being supported by at least two other major browsers. Whether it's Firefox, Chrome, Opera, or Safari. We want to know that there's industry support behind the feature. And I think that's important for you guys, because if we went ahead and implemented something and it's only in our browser, that's not something that's cross-browser. It's not standard. It's something that is only for us, or only for Chrome, or only for Safari, or whatever it might be. To us, we believe in cross-browser development, and that's why we take our time to really consider what we're going to put in. In addition, we want to make sure that the actual use case of a feature is interoperable. Does it work across all the browsers? If it works slightly different, then it's just not going to function for your use cases. You're going to have unexpected results. The big thing for us is something called candidate recommendation. That's when the W3C has gotten to a point where the specification is so mature that they feel that it's ready to be put out in general availability. That's what I like to call it. It's ready for public consumption. It's ready for you guys to use it, something that you're going to depend on, and it's not going to break the web. All right? Now, an emerging standard is a little different. All right? Think about when you have a new feature. If you run out and use a new feature that hasn't been properly vetted, hasn't been scrutinized, is still in a state of flux, do you think your site's going to kind of be stable? Who thinks their site's going to be stable? Good. I'm glad. All right. Anybody raise their hand, I'd say you're out of your mind. No, anyways. You got to give these features time to bake. You got to give them a chance to be vetted by industry experts, even, you know, developers in general, to make sure that they're meeting the proper use cases. And also, we want to make sure that even each individual browser vendor has a chance to take a look at a specific version of a spec and figure out what's the most useful thing, so that everybody can talk to each other and say, hey, you know, in this particular version of the spec, I found something really useful here. Now let's take this and kind of merge them together and come up with a final candidate recommendation. All right, it's really, emerging standards is a really important process for experimentation. So the way that it's designated is through vendor prefixes. Does everybody know, who knows what vendor prefixes are? Okay, cool, awesome. And so this is the time when you can experiment with new features. And what we've tried to do is give you a prefix that lets you experiment. So you can put it into your browser, you can put it into your source code, and figure out whether a specific feature makes sense for your specific use cases and your specific customers. So every major browser vendor has their own prefix. Microsoft has -ms. Chrome and Safari, which are WebKit-based browsers, have -webkit. Of course, you have Mozilla, which is -moz, and you have Opera, which is -o. And so if you look at this example right here, notice that we're talking about Flexbox, and of course, its prefix for Microsoft has -ms Flexbox, and in this case, for WebKit, -webkit Flexbox. All right? In addition, even platform APIs can be vendor prefix. So it's not only CSS properties, it's platform APIs as well. And if you notice, in this case, we're talking about request animation frame. And what we've done is prefixed it with Moz request animation frame, or WebKit request animation frame, or MS request animation frame. The key thing is that it allows you to experiment. And I'm going to use that word a lot, because that's what emerging standards are there for, to allow you to experiment. Not to put them in production and go hog wild, because things can change. And we'll touch on that in a little bit. One of the things that we like to do at Microsoft is give you the opportunity to experiment through our HTML5 labs. There are going to be features that we aren't ready to put into our browser. We just don't feel that they're ready to go. But we know that they could be ready very soon, and it's important to you guys to be able to be ready for that. So if you go to the HTML5 labs, and this was kind of an old picture, but notice that, you know, we have a couple of options, like the Media Capture API. Or when IndexedDB was out, we wanted to give developers the opportunity in Internet Explorer 9 to start testing offline database storage. So this is how we approach it. We feel it's a very responsible way, because it gives you guys time to figure out what the use case is for your site and also to make sure that the spec evolves at the right pace. The key thing for us is that we want to offer you features that you can depend on. And as web developers, you should be really excited about having features that you can depend on. You don't want your site to break. You don't want something to change that's going to cause your customers grief. Ultimately, you're building websites that you want to be beautiful, you want customers to be happy with, maybe you're monetizing it, but ultimately, you don't want them to break. And that's what we worry about. We want to give you features that you can depend on. And we do that by trying to minimize breaking changes. That's why the candidate recommendation standard is so important to us. Now, let me give you an example of how specs can change. CSS gradients is a really great feature. All right. Microsoft used to use filters for that. CSS gradients is the nice way of creating gradients now, and the best way of doing it. You know, it came out in 2008. In 2009, it became a working draft, which is kind of a little bit more of an evolved spec. And if you look at the way the syntax was specified, of course it's vendor prefix because it's not a candidate recommendation, but it gave you guys a chance to play with it. Now, who can tell me what the subtle difference is between the time that it was a working draft and the time that it became a candidate recommendation in 2012? Anybody? What's that? The word to. That little change was a subtle difference. Now imagine if you had gone ahead and said, I'm going to go buck wild, and I'm going to start using linear gradients as it was defined in 2009, and then the spec changed in 2012, and web browsers decided to implement that. Your site breaks. That means that it costs you time, resources, and customer dissatisfaction because you implemented something that wasn't a standard and it wasn't ready to go and it broke your site. And I'm stressing this because it's important. I want you guys to have great experiences. And that's why candidate recommendation is so important. Also, sometimes these specs need to bake. You know, everybody wants new toys. How many of you guys like new toys? Yeah. Okay, I have I'm going to say it. I have 5 kids, and they all love new toys. Every time I get a new toy, they all go wild. All right, but sometimes you know what happens when you have too many toys. You have too many, you don't know what to do. So you just want to play with all of them. Well, in this case, I'm going to give you an example. WebSockets, which is a fantastic API, that was put out there. And in 2010, a security issue was identified, which forced both Mozilla and Opera to pull it out of the browser. Now imagine this. You've built a whole business around WebSockets. And all of a sudden, a browser has to pull the feature out. What's the impact on your business? What's the impact on your customers? Your site is not functional anymore. The same happened with WebGL. It was such a big issue that CERT issued a worldwide advisory telling their customers not to enable WebGL. The reason is because these weren't given enough time to fully bake. They weren't ready for production, but developers used them, and some developers got burned. And it's sad. Now, typically what ends up happening is that after a while, once everything's vetted out and things are looking good, browser vendors are supposed to drop the vendor prefix. So the right way of specifying your code is something like this. Go ahead and experiment all you want. Do a dash webkit, dash moz. Make sure you use this. Specify the non-prefix version. Because what will happen is if the browser doesn't support the non-prefix version, it's going to ignore it anyways. But at least you know that once it does support it, all the stuff at the very top is ignored because those prefix should go away. And this will work. And this will be the finalized version. That means that if something does change and the spec has a 2, like 2 right, that means you only have to change it in one place. All right, this is best practices for defining, for playing and experimenting with features. Now, one thing that I've seen happening quite often, and this is actually a little concerning to me, and I'm gonna really harp on this, and I'm hoping that you guys consider this. I'm seeing things like this, WebKit Box Reflect. How many of you guys think that's a standard? Don't disregard my slide. How many of you guys think that's a standard? All right, good. It's not a standard. And I understand why some developers want it. This is a too many toys thing. It's a nice little feature, but it's not a standard. So what ends up happening is you're limiting your audience. You're basically saying that 70% of internet users will not be able to take advantage of this feature. And it reminds me of, how many of you guys remember those best viewed in days? Like best viewed in Netscape, best viewed in Internet Explorer. Yeah, that was kind of cool, right? Yeah, those are fun days, right? Yeah, targeting different browsers, being all ninja-like, yeah. All right. The problem is you are limiting 70% of the users. If, let's say, you decided you were only going to target WebKit. Well, I don't know. I think 48% of Internet Explorer users, 18% of Firefox users, and the 2.3% of Opera users, they'd like to have access to your site as well. And I think that's a pretty important thing. To me, I always focus on cross-browser. Everything I do is cross-browser. I don't like to limit my audience. I don't like to limit my options. How many of you believe in cross-browser development? Great. Awesome. That makes me happy. That makes me feel like you guys truly get the web. The web allows ubiquitous access to information. To me, the only way you can do that is through supporting, i.e., Chrome, Mozilla, Mozilla Firefox, Opera, and Safari. I'm a firm believer in that. And yeah, I work for Microsoft, but I'm a firm believer in cross-browser development, and we're firm believers. Even the Microsoft.com site, which you're going to hear about in a little bit, is truly cross-browser. And you're going to be surprised by the level of browser support that they've implemented. But I'm not going to steal his thunder. I'm going to let him talk to you about that. All right. Now, in addition, we talked about these vendor prefixes. And sometimes developers are, I'm going to say it, just like me, a little lazy. All right. You know, typing all this stuff in, let me go back. I hate that. I hate typing all this stuff in. All right. I am inherently lazy as a developer. All right. And I think, how many of you guys are lazy? Good. Thank you. I don't feel alone. It's like a support group, man. It's like, awesome. So if you're inherently lazy like me and you don't want to type in all these things, no problem. There are great open source tools out there that let you do this stuff very easily, so you don't have to worry about it. Preprocessors like SAS and Less, and preprocessing frameworks like Compass and Stylus, and even the JavaScript-based prefix-free library, which will add these vendor prefixes for you if it doesn't encounter it. So there's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to do it. Take advantage of these great libraries that are out there that make your CSS management so substantially easier for you. Don't just ignore the prefixes just because you don't want to type something. Use something like this that just makes it substantially easier. Now, if you're ever confused about whether something's a standard, I got an easy solution for you guys. Pull up your favorite search engine. I know everybody's favorite search engine is Bing, right? Okay, great, awesome, good, good. All right, so you Bing it, and you go in there and you type this in. And what I'm saying is, in here, I want to see if Box Shadow is on the W3C's site. And if I go there, and if I click on a link and it pulls up a specification for me, that's pretty good indication that this is something that's being considered as a true standard. If I go ahead and do Box Reflect, though, which I do know is not a standard, and it comes up with, I don't know, conversations on mailing lists, a couple of articles from some developers who thought it was cool and they want to put it up, it's pretty sure that it's not a standard, and you may want to consider whether you want to use it or not. All right? And if you have a laptop, give it a shot right now. I'll wait a second, you know? Go ahead and type in Box Reflect Site colon W3Org and see what you get. And you're going to see you're going to get mailing list discussions and things like that, but you're not going to find a specification. And that means you're using a proprietary feature which could go ahead and block out a good number of users to your site. Now, one of the issues I'm also seeing is browser fragmentation. And I constantly hear about the numerous versions of Internet Explorer that we have. And yes, we have 6, 7, 8, 9, and now 10. All right, we have 5 versions, and that's a lot. The interesting part is I did some homework on this, and I just wanted to kind of see what's going on. And I pulled this up about 2 weeks ago. This is kind of interesting because we talk about Internet Explorer in terms of browser versions, but man, I look here and I see there's Chrome 21, there is Chrome 22, Chrome 20, Chrome 17, Chrome 18, 19, 16, Chrome 18 Maxon Edition, which is the Chinese version. All right? And then here's Firefox. There's 15, 15, 14, there's 12. Wait a minute, there's Firefox 3.6, which if I'm correct is a 4-year-old browser. And it has about 1% market share. Now you're saying, 1%, what's the big deal about that? What if 1% equaled 1 million users? Would you think that's not a big deal? Who would like 1 million users to their website today? All right, whoever doesn't want 1 million users to your website, then you must be Facebook. All right? I would like 1 million users. But I'm trying to stress the point. Every browser has fragmentation. Every browser has multiple versions floating around there. And a lot of the browsers have a lot of users using them. Firefox 3.6 is a great example. It's still pervasive. It's still heavily used. And it still has a lot of users. So when you have fragmentation, what happens is you have varying feature support across different browsers and across different browser versions. And what I mean by that is that your favorite HTML5 feature may not work in a specific browser version. It may work in, let's say, Firefox 16. But in Firefox 3.6, you may not have that feature available to you. So what are you going to do then? You have to kind of figure this out. So what are the solutions on this? Well, the first one that we like to promote is feature detection. All right? I'm a big advocate of that. What we're talking about is checking to see if a browser supports a specific feature, not targeting a specific browser version. We're checking to see if that feature exists. Is it exist via an object, a property, a specific method, or a specific behavior? And if it does, great, then you act upon that. And if it doesn't, then you have a couple of options. You can go ahead and use polyfills and shims to mimic behavior. You can do a lot, maybe you just ignore it and offer a degraded experience. But feature detection gives you the most reliable way of determining whether something is available. And you always want to check for stable features. You don't want to check for emerging features because you can't be sure that they're going to be there in the same form once it's candidate recommendation. Remember what I mentioned? Between the time that it's initially drafted and between the time that it becomes candidate recommendation, things can change. So if you try to detect on something that's been, I don't know, in work for 3 years, things might have changed since then. Consider that. So why not check for a browser? Well, let me give you an example. This is a very common example of something that has been around for a long time. In this case, what we're saying is, if the browser is not Internet Explorer, let's use the W3C method, add event listener to bind an event. Makes sense. The reason this was around is because in versions prior to IE9, attach event was the preferred method for binding events. So notice that's why we're here. We're saying if it's not Internet Explorer, then that means it must be every other browser that support, and every other browser supports Add Event Listener because IE doesn't support Attach Event. I mean, doesn't support it. And we have to use Attach Event. Interesting enough, this would break if you used Internet Explorer 9. Well, technically it wouldn't break, but it could provide an odd experience for you. I'll tell you why. Internet Explorer 9 supports Add Event Listener. What if, in this case, you said, yeah, if it's not in Internet Explorer, Firefox, Chrome, whatever it is, I'm going to bind an event, and in that event, I'm going to have an experience that's totally custom to these other browsers, because I know it's not Internet Explorer. Well, guess what happens? Here comes Internet Explorer 9, and now in Explorer 10, hits this, Add Event Listener fires off, and you have totally unexpected results. Why? Because you weren't considering Internet Explorer. You were testing for a browser instead of testing for a feature. The better way of doing it is this. You're checking to see if Add Event Listener exists, and then you're acting upon it. And if it doesn't exist, then you check to see if Attach Event exists, and you act upon that. Is that pretty cool so far? Okay, great. So, what happens when feature detection looks like this? And again, I'm going to the lazy coder side of me. Who wants to type that in? I'll pay you to type that in. Anybody? Mike? No? Okay, sorry. All right, this is a feature detect that I pulled out of the Modernizer feature detection library for testing for at font face. Imagine if you had to do that all the time. That's pretty brutal. I don't want to do that, which is why I promote Modernizer. Modernizer is a great library that does awesome feature detection. It supports every major HTML5 and CSS3 feature out there. Who's familiar with Modernizer? Who uses it on a regular basis and loves it? Awesome, great. Okay, cool. And so I love it because it's well-maintained. It supports all the features that I care about in HTML5 and CSS3. It even supports things like geolocation, SVG, other nuances. It's great. Okay? It even includes the HTML5 shim so that if you're in a non-modern browser, it can support some of the article tags and things like that. Awesome stuff. All right? And the cool thing is it's constantly updated. It is well-maintained. It's a framework that you can depend on. So I did a poll recently. I just did a little survey. I wanted to find out what are the top front-end tools that developers are using on a regular basis. And I got a pretty good response, a little bit over 1,000 responses. And the interesting part is, of course, jQuery was number one. That was not unexpected. But the one that blew me away was Modernizer, where at least 50% of the developers are using it. That means that the developers get the value of feature detection, and they're leveraging it. And somebody else did a similar poll later on, a gentleman named PPK, Peter Paul Kolch, and he got a very similar result. So again, that reinforced my results and made me feel like Modernizer is something that's incredibly important. If you look at the feature set, it's pretty impressive. I mean, look at it. Supports at font face, background size, border radius. On the HTML5 side, you can check for drag and drop, IndexedDB, of course, geolocation, SVG. Lots of great functionality that you can test for and feel good that it's going to give you the right results. And again, it's stuff that you can put into your code and make sure that you're using feature detection as opposed to browser detection. So you can test for at font face this way if you want to, which is I find really brutal. I prefer doing this. All right, that's so simple. That is sweet. Yeah, and I wrote the code, so I feel it's pretty sweet. You know, so I mean, come on, seriously, it's modernizer.fontface. How much easier can you get? So yeah, you have a little bit of overhead by including a library, but the value, there's such a great value prop that it just makes sense to add it in. Now, how many of you have used polyfills or shims? Okay, good. All right, so a couple of you. That means that a lot of you may not be familiar with it, and this is good to know. Polyfills and shims allow you to mimic functionality that's typically standards-based. So let's say you want to use something like WebSockets. Great. IE10, Chrome, Firefox 16, all these major browsers support WebSockets, and you can put it in there, and you can take advantage of it. But non-modern browsers aren't going to support it. And let's say you want it to have a consistent experience across all your browsers. Well, that's what polyfills and shims allow you to do. So if I was using WebSockets, great. On a modern browser, I use the standards-based API that comes in the browser. In a non-modern browser, I fall back to a polyfill called Socket.io, which mimics the API to the T. That's the key difference here. It mimics the API. All right? It's typically JavaScript-based HTML, CSS stuff. And you use it when you want to provide that consistent experience. But let me state one thing. You don't have to offer it the same experience across all browsers. All right, understand that. A lot of people get tied up on that. They get hung up on saying, man, I need to be pixel perfect across every single browser. You don't need to do that. You don't need to offer the same experience. And again, Tyson's going to talk to you about that and what we did in Microsoft.com. So don't get hung up on same experiences, especially in non-modern browsers. You can't do it all the time. So what I typically like to endorse is a polyfill. And the reason I like to endorse a polyfill is because it does mimic the API. Basically, what we're saying is, if you use a polyfill, you're going to know that the methods and the properties that you're going to use are going to mimic the actual standards-based API. Now, with a shim, it's a little different. It's going to mimic the functionality of that standards-based API, but the API methods and properties are going to, might be totally different. So what's the pros and cons? Well, obviously, if you use a polyfill, the amount of code that you might have to adjust or refactor is small. Why? Because you're using the same API methods. With a shim, once the feature becomes standard and it's ready to go in the browser, you might have to do a lot of code refactoring. So here's an example of a shim. If you look at the CSS at the top, I'm making a call to border radius. Everybody know what border radius is, round the corners. Nice little feature, makes things look pretty. All right. But what happens when you, let's say you're in Internet Explorer 8. Well, Internet Explorer 8 doesn't support border radius. So what I've done here is I'm leveraging jQuery and Modernizer. I'm asking Modernizer to see if border radius is available in my browser. And if it's not, let's go ahead and use jQuery to dynamically load a corner plugin, inject it into my code, and then take every article element and give it rounded corners. This is what a shim does. It mimics that functionality. I would always prefer to have standards-based functionality. Why? Because it's standards and it's also more performant. But if I really needed to have that consistent look across the board, at least I know that I can fall back to this and tell good old Modernizer to check for me, and then tell good old jQuery to load this plugin, which will give me the rounded corners. That's a shim. It doesn't mimic the API calls, but at least it mimics the functionality for me. Now, some considerations. When you want to use a polyfill or a shim, you have to consider whether it's going to provide you with the functionality that you're expecting. Does it work the way you want? Does it mimic the standards exactly the way you're expecting? Next, you have to consider whether you can manage this going forward. For example, if somebody creates a polyfill and you leverage it in your code, and that developer decides, I don't really like this project anymore, I'm going to abandon it, who's responsible for that code later on? You guys are, right? So if you're not qualified to manage that code going forward, then you're kind of in trouble. You have to figure out, what am I going to do now? Do I need to hire somebody? Do I need to rewrite my code altogether? So you need to consider that. Lastly, you need to make sure that the API is consistent with what you're trying to accomplish. If you're going with a polyfill and the API is consistent, at least you know the code refactoring is minimal. If you're using a shim, you might have to do a lot of work. And that a lot of work equals time, money, customers. All right? Now, the takeaway I'm trying to give to you guys is, when it comes to standard, think in terms of stable standards. It's great to have all these toys. It's great to have emerging standards and things that you can play with. And yeah, experiment. Experiment to your heart's content, because you know what? When you experiment, you're going to figure out what the next iteration of your site is going to be. You're going to figure out how you're going to delight your users going forward. And then once things are ready, put them into production. But be careful about embracing emerging standards that they're just not fully baked, because it could cost you later on. And cross-browser does matter. I believe in cross-browser. I'm preaching it. I will preach it day and night. Anytime you hear me say anything about browser development, it's always cross-browser. And if anybody, anyone in this audience ever hears me say, target a specific browser, please come and slap me. All right? Not too hard. All right? But slap me. All right? And when you think about cross-browser, remember, you have options. You have, different tools. Detect for standards first, and then use something like Modernizer. And when you use polyfills and shims, be careful with them. Use them responsibly. And again, I'm going to reinforce this. You don't have to have the same user experience across the board. You can use progressive enhancement and say, you know what, man? I'm going to offer this great baseline experience for users. And for those with really awesome browsers, I'm going to offer them a superb experience. The interesting part is that you talk to developers who've actually embraced that, And in many cases, their users don't know the difference. Why? Because they never see those cool features. They have a great experience at the baseline, but they never see these cool new features. And lastly, test your site across all major browsers. There's so many tools available to you to test your sites. There's absolutely no reason why you can't do it. The one I'm recommending right now is browserstack.com. And the cool thing about BrowserStack is it works in your browser. So whether you are on Windows, Mac, or Linux, just go to browserstack.com and say, I want to test out my site in Safari or in Internet Explorer 6. I think they might have 7. I think they have baseline at 7. Or maybe you want to test out in Chrome or Firefox. The cool thing is this service is browser-based, and it gives you the ability to test in every major browser. Really cool. Now, you might be saying, that's great, Ray, but that means I have to push everything into production. Well, BrowserStack also allows you to tunnel into their service so you can test your stuff locally. Yes, you can have it's a little applet that allows you to tunnel in, and what it'll do is it'll test your local development environment remotely. It's really cool stuff. Check it out, browserstack.com. So I've given you a lot of information about standards. Giving you a lot of stuff to digest. We've talked about some of the ways to manage user experience, to manage expectations, to use standards responsibly. But, you know, giving you real-world feedback and real-world advice and experiences is a much better way to kind of drive the point home. And so what I'd like to do is pass it over to Tyson, who's going to do exactly that. He's going to share his experiences in redesigning Microsoft.com and to a responsive website and how the team's kind of done that.
All right. Thank you, Ray. So before I get started, I want to remind you of something that many people end up ignoring. And I also hope that it will end up changing the way you build your sites going forward. And that's that there is no standard screen resolution. And obviously, we know things like this aren't standards. These are more modern, but they're not standards. Smaller, but they're still not a standard. So what we see out there is many sites end up having their normal website built for their desktops and their laptops, and then they roll another version for their mobile sites, and it's all based on fixed pixel widths where your desktop site's maybe 900 pixels wide and your mobile site's 320. And that's exactly what we did for Microsoft.com in the previous version. Here on the left we have our desktop version, and on the right we have our mobile, but they have two different URLs, they have two different code bases, they have different content, and frankly, it's a lot of work to build and maintain these sites. And on top of it, our users don't end up getting the best experience. So we started trying to figure out, like, how can we get around this? What's the solution? And then we heard about something called responsive web design. And it promised us with a few things. First of all, it said that any screen or browser size is going to work. We're going to have a fluid layout. We can use the same markup, same CSS, same URL. But we realized that we weren't experts in responsive web design at the time. So we reached out to a small little three-man shop down in Austin, Texas, named Paravel. And they helped us build out the new version of the Microsoft.com homepage, which you'll see here. Now, I have three kind of fixed widths, if you want to say it. But the site will scale to any point in between. It'll scale larger, it'll scale smaller. And this allows us to use the same code base, use the same CSS, use the same content when we wish to. Now, going over a few little foundational things behind responsive web design, and I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard of Viewport, even if you haven't tried to do responsive web design, but you've tried to do maybe some mobile development. And what Viewport ends up being on a mobile device or a tablet is pretty much the entire screen size. But if you go into a desktop browser, it ends up being the inner width of the browser. Now, if you've ever tried to do mobile development, and you get your mobile site working great on your desktop browser just by scaling it in, and then you bring it over to your phone, you'll notice that it's all zoomed out and funky looking. But then you search around, hear about this thing called the Viewport meta tag, you slap it on there, and everything seems to work great. But if you try to search, like Ray had suggested, on the Viewport meta tag on the W3 site, it's not a standard. It's referenced there, but it's all referencing this new standard that's in working draft now, implemented by IE10 and Opera, allowing you to control the viewport through CSS, which is a standard. And I highly recommend you guys check this out, especially if you're building your site and you want to support the Win8 snap views. in IE10 to allow your site to respond responsibly. And highlighted down here in the pinkish color is what the viewport standard, if it goes to the candidate recommendation and so forth, would end up being. Now, really, the core foundation of responsive web design is something called CSS media queries. What media queries allow you to do is to adapt the layout and adapt your content to be able to fit the screen size. So I have a simple one shown here that says, if my viewport size gets to be 680 pixels or larger, let's just go ahead and change the font size. But you can imagine there's a lot of other things I could end up doing in here. I could end up clearing a float, adding a float, repositioning something, hiding something, collapsing something. So this slide here shows our breakpoint timeline, representing really where our different media queries are firing on our page and how our content's reflowing. So from the left-hand side, you see 540 pixels and under, and then on the far right-hand side, I have 1600 pixels and growing above. So we start off with a one-column layout. We have a masked hero unit. We grow up. Our footer goes into two columns. Our logo gets a little bit bigger. Then we go three column and so on and so forth. And I think you know where this is going. But when you think of, if you're going to go responsive and you build out your breakpoint timeline, I encourage you, don't just do it at the end. Also think about this up front and then change it as you go. This is going to be a vital asset to your test team as well as the people that program your site in the production environment. If you imagine you're a tester and you're testing a fixed width site, it's pretty easy. You can have a JPEG screenshot of the website and say, do these match? But when you go into a responsive world, they're obviously not going to deliver you with 500 or 1,000 images of every width in between. So these breakpoint timelines allow them to see at what points things should be happening and if they're happening or not. It also allows the content, the production teams, to be seeing when they're programming content in, what points should they be looking at to ensure things fit correctly on the site. So back in June and July timeframe, we did a little experiment in production where we redirected a small percentage of our users over to a static version of a static HTML, static CSS for a responsive Microsoft.com homepage just to see how things would work out. And it worked pretty well. But then once we started trying to convert that and integrate it into our content management system, we realized we had an issue. Previously, we gave our content authors this flexible grid system where they could specify grid units and saying, well, I want a grid unit here, and this is one grid unit means maybe 12 pixels or whatever. And they could kind of create their own layout and then push that out, and it just worked. But we know that doesn't work in a responsive world. So the answer that we ended up finding to that for us was a proportional grid where instead of a grid unit being a certain pixel width, it ends up being a fractional unit depending on the size of your viewport. So you can see on the mobile device, everything's just one column. But as you scale up into maybe a tablet or something like that, and you had where you maybe had two cells stacked on top of one another, we break them out so they're side by side. And then you have another one where maybe three are stacked, it ends up breaking up into thirds or quarters. Now, obviously, we just chose to go down to quarters because that worked for our site. But you could take this concept and break it down to if you really wanted to do sixteenths or something like that. And you just have media queries along the point that end up reflowing and choosing, do you want to reflow these this way or this way? Now, cross-browser support, as we all know, is getting a lot better. And one of the reasons it's getting a lot better, really the reason, is because of standards, as Ray had talked about. Browsers are getting really good at implementing the standard, so as a developer, it's not too hard for me to go build a site. I look at it on, I choose my browser of choice, I develop it, and now I'm just bug fixing on the other ones. What happens if your browser matrix looks a little something like this? So we do extensive testing on over 25 browser OS combinations, then we do some other smaller testing on other ones. So you can see we have 5 major versions of Internet Explorer, 3 versions on the phone. We have Chrome, Firefox, Safari, Safari on iPad, iPhone, Android tablets, phone, and Kindle Fire. And it takes a lot of work. And it's something, if you're going to take the plunge into doing mobile development or doing a responsive site, that you're going to have to think about. But I think it's definitely worth it. And as Ray had mentioned, think about your users. Don't just build your site for what your preferences are because you think one browser is cooler than the other. Think about what browsers your users are actually using. Now, older browsers, what do you do with them? Especially when you want to go responsive and you have a browser like IE6 or IE7 that doesn't support CSS media queries. We could obviously go out and use an open source JavaScript library. We could roll our own to add support. But that's a lot of extra time. You're taking on maybe a third-party dependency. Are they going to upgrade it? And is it really beneficial? Is it beneficial for you, and is it beneficial for your users? So what we decided for a responsive site on some of these older platforms that it wasn't beneficial. So we went with a locked layout. And we could have done this with JavaScript, but we ended up using user agent detection in this point. And I'll get to that in a minute. Because if we use JavaScript to add this in with, like, add a CSS class and now we can lock the layout, what happens if the user doesn't come in with JavaScript? Then they just get a completely broken experience. So we went with user agent detection to target IE6, IE7, IE8 so we could fix the layout with. And you can see IE6 rendered here on the left with IE10. And the sites look pretty similar. Obviously, you can tell the differences because they're side by side. But if you were just a user browsing the site, and frankly, right now, a lot of users out there, there's still a lot on IE6, and they're getting very, very broken experiences. And we have some things where maybe our PNG isn't transparent and whatnot, but it's all right. And as we scroll down the page, you can see we have this for home, for work tab section on IE6 where it's not a tab, it's just all shown, but the users can still access the data that they need to access. And we didn't have to waste all the extra time having to make fixes to bugs and retest them and iterate. So as you heard me mention, we do use user agent detection in some spots, and which is really frowned upon in the community, as it should be. Because user agent detection, we all know, is going to require maintenance. And feature detection is end up making your site future friendly. But sometimes user agent detection is required in specific cases. So some cases where we use it is one for targeting our content towards our users, whether or not that's targeting like a person on IE7 to tell them to upgrade, hey, IE10's out. Or a case that's very relevant to you guys is you have a person come in on an iPhone and a person come in on a Windows phone. Don't you want to tell them that you have an app available on their platform instead of just saying, hey, I have all these apps available. Why not just show them the one that's relevant to them? There's a case where we use it for video in a specific case where Safari on a PC, it supports HTML5 video, but it needs QuickTime. And we couldn't figure out how to make that work using feature detection. So we opted to go with UA detection. Local web fonts on Android, I'll go into that in a minute. Feature detection, we use it obviously for eventing. We use Modernizer for checking some touch events, CSS3 animations, and web fonts. And like I said, with video, we use UA detection. We also use feature detection for video. Now, typically, when we think about feature detection, we often first think about HTML5, CSS3 features. But now, we're going to have to start thinking about images. Every single day, new devices are released that have just amazing display qualities with high pixel densities that if you just serve up your normal 1x image, normal typical image size, you're going to get something like this. So here we have the Microsoft logo. As you can see, the one on the left, while it's a smaller file size, it's a little blurry. So we decided in some scenarios, it's worth downloading the extra bytes to have the user have our brand displayed well. Now, how we did this case in particular was with a picture polyfill, and I'm sure some of you guys have heard about it. Scott Gell released his open source. I'll be blogging on this later this week, so feel free to follow me on Twitter, and I'll update a Twitter post to my blog at that time. And what happens here is you can see there's no image element other than the one in the NoScript tag, so we have down-level support for browsers without JavaScript. But we parse this from the bottom up, and what ends up happening eventually, in this case, let's say we're on an iPad. So we have a minimum device pixel ratio of 2, and the screen size is larger than 539 pixels. So we end up inserting that image element into the DOM, and the browser then goes out and fetches that image. Similarly, we use this for a large hero unit because it's a 1600 pixel wide image. Do you really want to download a 1600 pixel wide image on a mobile device? I don't think so. But what's interesting here is I have an attribute that I added of disable swap below and data defer, and these are features that we added to the polyfill, to if you load the site in, let's say, a landscape mode, and then you flip it into a portrait mode, since it just needs a smaller image, let's not go fetch another image. Let's just scale down the current one we have. But if you go from a portrait to a landscape and you need a bigger image, only in that case will we go fetch it. Data defer, that's used for if we want to postpone the loading of an image until after the body on load has fired, which is great for a slideshow where we don't need the last image loaded right away. We want to load that later on. You can see it finally processed here. Now, web fonts. Web fonts are, I'm surprised more people don't use them. If you talk to any designer in print medium, they're going to go crazy on fonts on how much they use them. But on the web, it's really, really underutilized. And there's basic support in all major browsers out there. Even IE6 ends up supporting web fonts. And you have an easy degradation story back to local system fonts, which you're already using today. Now, obviously, you're going to have to be careful of the file sizes because files can get large. So what we end up doing, along with the many others, is we break them up by only the required characters. So if you go to our homepage right now, and you'll see in the Fiddler watch, and if you look at the file path, the ENUS, ENCA, these Western European countries are going to download one font pack. We have another font pack for Eastern European, one for Vietnamese, and so on and so forth. But then locales such as China or Japan, there's just too many characters to make the file download reasonable. So we fall back to local fonts in those areas instead. Now, basic rendering is just to drive it home that, like, you can render it in Seago UI and it's great. It makes the Microsoft brand look great. But you fall back to Tahoma, it still works great for your users. So why not do this instead of only having everyone get that? And the file sizes aren't really that big in most cases. Defining the web font, I'll let you guys search online to go over the exact syntax, but I wanted to call out the two parts that are highlighted. The first is make sure you name it accordingly. Be careful not to conflict with a local system font, or you might have some unexpected things happen. Additionally, I had mentioned that we use UA detection for web fonts, and that's for the reason called out in red. If you loaded it up with local fonts on an Android device or a Kindle Fire, what it's going to do is it sees a local font and says, I don't know how to support this, so I'm going to ignore your entire font face rule declaration when it could have just fallen back to your web font supplied with the URLs. So we have to use user agent detection, because feature detection didn't work for us, to not admit the local fonts on those devices. Now, using web font, pretty easy. You can fall back to your system fonts if it doesn't load. And then icon fonts. Very useful now once you have these high-density displays coming out, because your icon fonts end up giving you a vector image that you can rescale. You can change the color of the icon through CSS, noting that you can only have one color, just like you can't have a letter M and have it be half blue, half red. And you also save on HTTP requests, which makes your site load faster, similar to what you'd be getting with CSS spriting. And I'll go into the cons in a minute. And then here you have our icon font pack that we use for the Microsoft.com homepage. Pretty simple, just a few little icons. Defining the icon font, same exact thing you'd end up using for defining a web font. But now you go into using it. And what we opted to do, obviously we could have had this little character codes highlighted in purple here in our markup, but then a search engine or a screen reader is going to be like, what the heck does this mean? So instead, since it is really for display purposes and it's not actual content, we use CSS feature of after and being able to inject the content of that character code, and then you get the styled icon to show up. Now, if the client doesn't support the icon font, you can use Modernizer to detect that they don't support, that they have no font face, and just go back to a simple CSS background image like you probably are using today. Now, there's obviously a lot of things that we could have went over with the homepage and what we did, but I wanted to make sure that I left you with a couple of the key things that I thought were important in going responsive. And kind of in recap, that's the breakpoint timeline. And when you define your breakpoint timeline, think outside just common devices. If you go and say, well, a common mobile device size is 320 pixels wide, but if the breakpoint doesn't really have to happen until 400 pixels wide and your content looks great there, do it at 400 pixels. Make your content drive when your breakpoints fire. Think about your grid system, how you're going to integrate your responsive design into your content management system. How are you going to handle image sizes? And then browser support and test plans. Are you going to use something like Browser Stack? Are you going to have to go buy physical devices? What happens if you have a very gesture-heavy website where a lot of these emulators aren't going to work for you? And lastly, be all in. Don't try to go halfway responsive. You're going to find that it's not going to work well for you. Imagine you have a fixed width asset, whether it be some third-party widget or some asset you've built, or maybe an ad that's set at 600 pixels wide, and you try to scale your browser in. Once you get under 600 pixels, what are you going to do? It's not going to reflow appropriately. Maybe you need to hide the asset at that time or swap it out with a smaller fixed size asset. And lastly, decide, is responsive actually the right thing for your website? We found on Microsoft.com, it's been great. Our users have been loving it. We have higher engagement numbers than we did previously, yet our maintenance costs and development costs have gone down. So I'm going to hand it back over to Ray to close this up.
Cool. Thanks, Tyson. So, you know, it's never been a better time to be a web developer. There's so much stuff going on, so many exciting new features. And we finally have browsers that they adhere to standards, and they have tremendous feature support. And you can do so many exciting things on the web. And the key thing is to understand what features are available to you now and what you need to experiment with. And thankfully, we do have Tyson here, who's given us some real-world examples of what they had to go through to leverage a pretty comprehensive browser matrix. So thank you very much, Tyson, for that information, because it's been great. And so what we want to do at this point is we want to close out the session, and we want to offer you guys an opportunity to ask us questions. We're going to do a Q&A session, so if anybody has questions, step up to the mic or, you know, come on over here and talk to us. We're glad to help out. Thanks for attending, guys.